Thanks for being with me this next hour. You are listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks, asking the question, why wait for heaven? On 1-2 Radio, changing the way we experience life and spirituality. And Happy New Year! Today is January 8th, 2016. Can you believe it? And on today's show, I'm happy to welcome back writer, web designer, and ACIM teacher Bruce Rawls. Now, in December, when Bruce was here on the show, we talked about an online course that both of us had participated in, presented by the Foundation for A Course in Miracles. And that course was exploring the idea that we all wear masks, that we're literally participating in not only a big dream, but a big masquerade ball in which we are all wearing masks. But somehow, we've kind of forgotten that fact, and we start taking as serious the masks that we wear, not realizing that they're really nothing more than a cover, nothing more than a pretense. Now, when we had that discussion, we barely scratched the surface of our notes. So today we thought we would at least use that as a jumping off place for our discussion. So while you're listening, I would invite you to join us in the 12radio.com private group on Facebook. And one of the easiest ways to get there is to go to the 12radio.com website. And on the left side of that page, you're going to see a chat link. Go ahead and click that. You'll be automatically redirected to our private group on Facebook, and you can just ask to join. Now, you don't need to be there, but if you want to, you can post questions, you can post comments, etc. That's one way to participate in the show. So I would invite you to do that. And so let's just get going. And but you'll see me over in the chat room, but let's just get going. Welcome, Bruce. How are you this morning?
Hi, CA, and Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year. I love 2016.
So far, so good, huh?
Yeah, well, I've been telling people that 16 has always been my favorite number.
Oh, okay.
And so since I've not been alive, at least in this body, you know, during a 16 year, this is kind of, you know, important.
There you go.
Right? You know? I wasn't around in 1916, at least not in this body.
Right. We all have our, I suppose, numerological and so many other ologies of you know, special favorite things and unfavorite things, and you know, which kind of ties into the masks. You know, with those are, so those are some of the things that we hide behind in a way, aren't they?
I mean, oh yeah, I mean, and they're all superstition, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know that something's lucky, but I just always like the number 16. I like the number 6, and so I just think it's at least it's writing it out on things. It's fun.
Uh huh.
You know,
yeah,
it's fun for me.
And we all do it. I do it too. I have, you know, numbers that I say, oh, that's cool. You know, that whole thing of thinking it's, you know, somehow interesting or special or unique or different or whatever. And that's, of course, just an interesting way of keeping ourselves in the dream. Huh?
Well, that's right. I mean, there's just, you know, like here again in this class, and we've talked about it before, it's just this idea of fragmentation.
Right.
You know, instead of believing in the one, we would, you know, we kind of fell asleep or whatever you want to call it. We fell asleep and we're dreaming that there's all these fragments and that all the fragments are different. And so some of the fragments are special, like 2016. You know, 16 is special. It's more special than 2015 or something like that. But just believing that the form is real rather than the content behind it.
And it's so pervasive, isn't it?
I mean, Yeah. You know, it's not only so pervasive, but just, you know, I keep being hit over and over again that the only way to wake up from the dream is to literally get a message from outside of the dream.
That's it. That's
you
it.
Know, that we really believe that somehow studying something within the dream, studying the forms, being really, really familiar, you know, it's almost like studying psychology, that once if you study the disease, if you study the level of illness, that somehow that's going to correct it. And nothing in the world, nothing within the dream can really speak of outside the dream.
Right.
And
right.
So we're just going around and, I mean, they're fun circles that we go around in, but, you know, or at least some of the times, but that's it. We're just going around in circles.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all part of the dream repair technician approach, isn't it?
Yeah. The dream repair. I love that. I love the little things you come up with.
Well, I try to find metaphors that work for me and share them in hopes that maybe they would help somebody else too. Because I find myself, putting that virtual hat on a lot. And when I catch myself, usually just instants after, having, thoughts like that we're, sharing and revelations and aha moments that momentarily I choose to look from above the battleground of duality and kind of chuckle at what I'm doing. And then of course, right after that, like Ken Wapnick says, the big vacuum cleaner, over the doorway when you leave the workshop or switch off of the 1-2 radio connection or go to something else that is, we're busy doing. And it's not about the form. It's all, again, as we've been talking, it's about the mind's decision to think that, we are these separate individuals with separate agendas doing separate things in a separate world and yada, yada, yada. And thinking that somehow our peace of mind is contingent on, what happens or doesn't happen in that. And again, it's the specifics,
Well, and we do that all the time. I mean, I'm thinking how many people have been involved in meditation for years. And but there's something about, okay, you sit down, you do your meditation, but then you get on with your real life.
Right.
And so we do that all the time, is that we separate, we classify, we categorize without ever realizing that most of the time the idea is for that to literally, cover or meld or somehow seep into the rest of our lives. And maybe that's just me, but I've got these really tight little categories. So yes, here I am meditating and being very calm or doing whatever I'm doing. Maybe it's reading the Course in Miracles or reading something from the course, and then shut the book, and then it's on with real life. And no, it's supposed to eventually really color everything.
Or maybe uncolor.
Uncolored, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, because I think we filter and distort and separate by, like you say, cubbyholing and pigeonholing the categories of our lives and the segments that well, I can apply this here, but not there. And of course, right off the bat, asks us to generalize. Workbook, or actually not workbook, the text principle number one. That there's no order of difficulty in miracles, and the idea behind that is, if there's any kind of order, then there's, like to paraphrase George Orwell, some animals are more equal than others. It's saying some areas of our life are more difficult than others. Anytime we make exceptions and distinctions and exclusions, we're basically saying, I'm not quite ready to be peaceful because I don't want to include this area of my life in what I understand or what, believe to be true.
Yeah. Well, and once again, I think we do that all the time. I mean,
Oh,
I'll
yeah.
give you an example of this is like pre-course, but I worked in the area of spinal cord injury research and brain injury research. And one of the things, I mean, I think for my whole life, I've always leaned towards alternative and complementary medicine. And very much, even when I was in grade school, was reading metaphysical things about how our bodies really respond to what we tell them to do. And so I kind of grew up believing, not that we could just cure everything, but that for the most part, your attitude was where it was all at, that anything in your body could be changed by whatever your thought system was. I mean, coming from a very metaphysical or whatever you want to call that kind of mindset. And then when I started doing spinal cord injury research, I recognized that was one of the first times I said, well, everything but this. This probably can't be changed. And and I knew I was even doing that, and I said, okay, what is this about? And I realized part of it was probably being so enmeshed in that world, and also understanding that for so many people, for the clients that I was dealing with, the patients, that if they would not accept kind of what you'd call the reality of what was going on, it was harder for them to put their lives back together and kind of then make a really great life for themselves if they continually held on to the fact, I'm going to be healed or I'm going to be cured. And so I think even in my own mindset, I said, yep, this is one of those things that your mind can control a lot, but it's not going to put that spinal cord back together. And yet, even when I was doing, I go, okay, why is this the exception? Why do you feel like this is the exception? And so, you know, and that was a little bit before I started studying the course. So maybe that was one of the ways, you know, I was coming into that, you know, questioning why do you make exceptions in your life that one thing can be cured, one thing can be easy? Because I certainly do that with the course. It's easy to forgive some people and not so easy to forgive others.
Yeah.
And that shouldn't, that's not true.
That's what the course tells us.
Well, it's not true in what the course would be reality. You know,
right.
It seems true in my reality.
Yeah, and what you're touching on there, I think, is a really important subject too. Is the whole what the course jargon would call level confusion, and which again gets back to, you know, our dream repair attempts, and how we so easily lapse into forgetting that it's all about the mind. And jump back into trying to change the circumstances, whether it's a spine or a, you know, brain injury or a, you know, health regimen or, you know, our finances or our schedule or relationships or, you know, pick anything that seems to be going on in our physical material lives, as we think of them or believe them to be. And it's just so amazing how quickly we jump back into that. And I think that's where the process of forgiving ourselves for making the investment in an identity that's tied up with those things. It's so important and you know, such a pivotally, you know, crucial and helpful part of the course's primary teaching, that we need to somehow give ourselves permission to, you know, take all the time we want to take. Not that it's necessary to drag it out, and we would hope that we would not want to, you know, really suffer any longer than is necessary. But if we feel like we're not quite ready for, you know, a peace that transcends what we oftentimes experience, that's okay. It's, you know, and I was just in a study group last night, and we read the section, you know, not one note in heaven's song was missed. And so there's no harm in truth. but the delay is needless, which kind of ties into your show's theme there, you know, why wait for heaven?
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, now here's something, and I'm opening up a can of worms, I realize, but, you know, I love to open up the can of worms. Because here again, I'm convinced I can understand this intellectually, right?
Well,
I've been thinking recently, and I think they touched upon this too, in the workshop, but it's the idea that you can only, it's the voice of God or the voice of the Holy Spirit, however you want to say it, from outside the world that is going to convince you that the world is a hallucination or that this is a dream. And yet, so I know that there's some part of our mind that we literally brought it with us into the dream. That's our right mind. And yet, when I read the things in the course that say the world can never be a reflection, the world, the things of the world are never a reflection. And then I start getting a little confused. And maybe that's level confusion too. So, you know, it's almost like, how do I know the difference? You know, that the things of the world are not really ever a reflection of not the world.
You know,
am I articulating that well?
I think so. And well, I'm not sure if I am relating to what you're saying exactly, but I'll put something on, see if it helps.
Okay.
Because I find it helpful when I remember to think along those lines, is that since there are two levels, the level of truth, there is no opposite to truth, and that's what we really are, and there, you know, we don't have to do anything or you know, try to achieve anything, because we are everything. But that's not where we think we're at. So that's really not where most of the course is addressed, although it seems to reflect, and since you mentioned the word reflection, in the awareness and the longing for that awareness, that I think is, you know, what we brought with us into the dream, which we symbolize by the Holy Spirit or the Jesus of the voice of the course. I like to use inner kindness teacher, but that those metaphors then are the reminders that are really all of us, that we think of as part of us, that we brought into this dream so that we would have a memory and not completely be cut off from what we never left, and eventually would make our way back to that awareness. But what on the level that we think we're at, which is the level two that the Course refers to, that's where we're constantly choosing between what the Course refers to as a wrong and right-minded thinking, or you know, the false and the real. The real world, of course, is actually connected to the truth. But okay, maybe those aren't the right words. But essentially, the two illusions, the illusion of the ego and the illusion of the realm of forgiveness that undoes the ego, and the forgiveness, to me, the more I seem to, you know, stumble upon occasionally, and so hopefully more often, and it does seem like it's more often, apply that and catch myself and switch over to that more right-minded thinking, where I don't condemn someone else and don't condemn others, which is really synonymous. Those are those moments where I do find even momentary a greater peace, and those moments are when I'm not trying to change anything externally. I'm just appreciating the fact that I can use any specific to bring it back to the generalized awareness that is, it's reflection of what's beyond words, but that awareness, that understanding, it's what we all are in truth, and we have it, and we are it, and you know, tag, we're it.
Yeah.
But we're so preoccupied with our culture of fixing things externally, and then we even have, you know, this whole vast realm of New Age and metaphysical systems, like not single one out, but The Secret is I think a good example of where they touch on the fact that the mind is primary, and then almost in the same breath, or at least the same sentence, practically, as they jump back into, okay, now this is how we're going to change your life, you know, and mm-hmm. with the assumption being that your life is what's happening in the world.
Well, I don't think it's level confusion so much, but that's one thing that can be confusing, I think, for people that also do, you know, let's call it the New Age,
uh-huh.
you know, although I think the New Age was probably in the 1800s, but let's just call it the New Age. Well, don't you think, you know, that's when the New Age really came about, is somewhere around 1860 or something like that. But anyway, just that idea that we confuse, like, for instance, when we say the mind in the Course, we're not talking about the body's brain.
Right, exactly.
And oftentimes they are talking about the body's brain.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And yep. those are not the same thing, at right. least not according to the Course. And I do that too. I mean, we'll talk about changing your mind or you know, something going on in the brain, but when we're really talking about the physiological brain or the processes of the brain of the body, well, the body is still a symbol in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the mind. The mind is, according to the Course, outside of the world.
Yes.
It's outside of the dream. And see, so that, you know, that's a little confusing to me. But there again, that's just words. And most of the time, if I'm listening to somebody, I can figure out where they're, you know, what definition of mind they're using.
Yeah, from the context usually.
Yeah, from the context.
Right, right. Yeah, and that it's you know, like Ken Wapnick says, it's one of the Zen koans, you know, it says we read in the Course, you know, brains don't think, eyes don't see, ears don't hear, and you know, how do you make sense of that? Well, as a body, if we're identified with this dream figure that says I'm Bruce or I'm CA or whatever, we're not going to get it. I mean, it's not going to happen from there. And so, just like Einstein's, you know, paraphrased and somewhat adapted, you know, classic quote of, you know, problems aren't, and I'm going to paraphrase it, of course, that aren't solved from the level of thinking that created them. They're made up. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I've always loved that idea. I've loved that quote.
Yeah, because that's not where it happens. But the mask that, you know, tying into the theme of that Temecula workshop is the idea that somehow the dream figure has a capacity to fix the dream problem. And, well, we can do things that appear to, you know, temporarily mitigate the situations in our lives, and that's what we spend most of our time, it would seem, doing. And there's nothing wrong with that, and it would be silly to not do the things that we think are helpful, but that's the entire realm of those things are not what the Course addresses. And it's easy when you read the Course and see metaphors where it talks about, you know, the lawns of heaven and the flowers and walking gently down a forest in summer. And, you know, there's a lot of poetry in the course that's interspersed with the metaphysics. And it'd be real easy, you know, and it talks about, you know, God crying, you know, weeping for our being missing us, things like that. You know, they're all metaphors so that we from the level that we think we're at, we don't feel like we're left out. And that there is, you know, it's really basically speaking to our longing to return to that awareness where we realize that, you know, there can't possibly be, in truth, anything left out. If there is, then it's not perfect oneness. And that's a hard thing to wrap our brains around because our brains aren't going to ever get it. They were designed to not get it. And same with our senses, you know, that's just a prerequisite for identification with those things is, you know, that is part and parcel with how those systems operate. And we can't go beyond that from within that system. But fortunately, we've all been drawn to A Course in Miracles and the types of things that relate to what we're talking about because on some level, we know, like that little child in Workbook Lesson 182 says, we know that this isn't our home. We know there's something more, as Helen and Bill, agreed upon. There's got to be a better way here. And that better way is really back into the mind, back into using the mind to undo the identification with a dream world. And while not necessarily trying to change it, but changing our thoughts about the world, as the Course says over and over again in so many different ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and something you said that it kind of, I mean, like I said, I like to go round and round with all this intellectual stuff, and I know that's never the answer, but it's hard for me not to.
Oh, we all do. We all do, yeah.
But one of the things that you said that I think kind of really gets it, or, you know, you can just kind of go back to is, are you trying to fix the world?
Yeah.
Because if you're trying to fix the world, then yeah, you're not in the right place. And I think, you know, I think even why do some of us come to the Course? And I think that's it, because we've tried to fix the world for so long and we haven't been able to do it.
Yes.
And we're kind of frustrated or tired of like, oh my gosh, I don't think this can be fixed. You know, maybe this can't be fixed. And then when that's when maybe we're willing to see something differently.
Right, right.
And go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, that reminded me of that section in the last chapter of the text in chapter 31, you know, the real alternative, because I find I'm drawn to that over and over again, because it seems like that's where we reach that critical juncture in so many, you know, sometimes people call those episodes a dark night of the soul, where
yes.
where you just like, okay, I've tried everything, you know, and the usual ego approach is something that's very bleak, you know, sometimes even suicidal, but you know, this sort of desperation level. But that's where it says, and so poignantly and perfectly so, that that's where the greatest lesson can be learned. And I'm glancing up at your highlighted notes in the Academy class workshop. You know, don't stop halfway. And that's where a lot of times we sometimes, you know, say, oh, well, I won't deal with this. And then we, you know, lapse back into a different strategy of ego to, you know, try to mitigate the dream instead of looking at the cause. You know, never once did we think our guilt was among the causes, you know.
Right.
But that's what the real alternative is saying, I could look at this guilt with the Holy Spirit. I could go beyond the outer shield of oblivion, which is the world and all of its space-time persona body stuff. I could go past that, you know, seemingly brick wall, this, you know, granite mountain that's really a wisp, and go to the thing that ego trembles even the thought that we would look at objectively, which is the unconscious guilt, and see that there's nothing there. It's unconscious, but it's also fortunately unfounded. And the fact that it's unfounded, it gives us the infinite hope. And truly, our true choice is again, it's all, and it comes at it from the Course in so many different ways. Is that, you know, our one real choice that is left available to us is to choose in the mind against the ego, and that's all that's necessary. But we have to do it by looking at it, and by looking at it, we mean, you know, moment to moment, seeing the desolation that's there and seeing how pathetically, I mean, just at face value, if we look at it identified with it, oh yeah, it's incredibly depressing and discouraging. You know, if we think, oh well, you know, the 80 or if you take good care of your body, you know, maybe a century, give or take, you know, and
yeah.
and then if we just identify with that, but even beyond that, if we think that we're limited to just a part of totality, you know, that's like the booby prize. That's second best. That's, you know, door number 17 instead of the whole enchilada, you know, I'm mixing a lot of metaphors there, but I think we have these little mini dark nights of the soul. Anytime we get just momentarily frustrated or discouraged or anything that, you know, the course would talk about as a negative thought or emotion, those are all cues that if we're taking it from the ego, then our as part of chapter 21 says, you know, our cues for inference are wrong. And, but the cue from the Holy Spirit is, hey, look at why you're choosing this. Look at why you want to identify with this, and forgive yourself for wanting to identify with that. Just even if just for a moment, that loosens the ego's white knuckle grip on our identity. And then we, from there, are free to, you know, choose again and choose the allness, the all of spirit instead of the nothingness of the ego. And that is a peace and an ecstatic awareness that's beyond anything we can imagine. And I think we were talking, you know, alluding to that earlier, is, you know, that our brain can't possibly grok that. There's no way that we could possibly, you know, fathom what that's like from within the dream. But that's what we really are, isn't it?
Yes. Well, and I'm thinking even during this course, one of the things, and I think it was Jeff said it, the purpose of the course is to bring the unconscious into the conscious.
Yeah.
That's the purpose. And so, you know, here again, once again, we want to get all complicated about what it is about, but that's what it's about. It's about encouraging us to stop and to examine everything in our lives and to make the unconscious conscious. And then it reminds me, but that's where you go into the dark night of the soul. You know, because you're all of a sudden like, I'm rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, you know, which is an image I love.
Me too.
Because that's just what it is. We just think that we're going to make this big difference, but it's still going to sink. I mean, you know, it's still the dream. Right. And so you kind of go into these. And I like that idea, the mini, you know, black nights of the soul, because I think that's kind of what it is. I'm not sure it's this one process that all of a sudden you step out and emerge, because at least I find with myself, I kind of go in there and the next thing I know, I'm trying to do like what you said, I'm mitigating it again. Oh, this way I can fix this. Right. And I'm all, you know, I'm rearranging the deck chairs again, thinking that I can fix it. And, you know, then I'm thinking of something that is in the manual for teachers, and, you know, it would kind of, it doesn't say let's not be bliss ninnies, although that's something that I think Ken used to say, you know, but if you're still in that stage of let's be a bliss ninny, let's just say all is good and the, you know, God has a great will for all this, you know, and all of that, then we haven't quite hit that darkness, or we've hit that darkness and we just don't still want to look at it. But that whole idea of, and here again, I think it was Jeff said, don't go halfway.
Right,
you know,
right.
You've got to keep moving through that, because if you move through the darkness and the frustration of realizing I can't fix this and that's all I'm ever doing is trying to fix it, you'll realize why and you'll realize where the real world is. Can we just get there, though? Can we just get there?
Are we there yet, Daddy?
You know, I mean, going back to those workbook lessons, I'm never upset for the reason I think, and I could see peace instead of this. I mean, that's it. I could see peace instead of this in this moment if I were willing to give up my investment in the dream.
Mm-hmm. I'm never upset for the holodeck chair that I think I'm sinking on.
Right. Boy, I'll tell you what, that lesson number 5, I'm never upset for the reason I think. Oh my gosh, that is absolutely my best and my favorite go-to.
It's a good one, isn't it? And I'm once again doing the workbook lessons chronologically from the calendar year perspective. And, and it's just amazing, you know, how if you just kind of stick with it, again, it's going past the ego's initial resistance, looking at that, forgiving yourself for countless relapses and reindulgences in that, you know, dysfunctional, maladaptive, but ultimately forgivable, choice. and saying, gee, yeah, that I really can see that I've given everything the meaning that it has, and the thoughts that I've had from that limited perspective don't mean anything. And I'm seeing only the past, you know, like today's, you know, I'm recording this a day early, but anyway, that you know, all those lessons, especially the early ones, are packed because it's holographic, and they're, every single one has the whole thought system in it, just as the specific Titanic that we think we're on, that seems like it's a much more woeful, you know, dismal sinking ship than someone else's sinking ship, you know, and we deserve special pity. it's the same holodeck. It just is camouflaged and decorated differently, but you know, it's all cake frosting. And what elaborate special effects you've been able to achieve with our minds to paint and skin. You know, use a metaphor for the you know, your maybe your iPhone case or whatever. You know, sometimes they call those skins or applications. You know, it's the surface. It's the facade. It's the covering, that back to the mask. You know, it's the deception that is trying to convince us that we're something that we're not. And so those holodecks can be very convincing, and especially when it's the 3D, you know, complete with tactile, olfactory, and as well as the audiovisual stuff, you know. And wow, what an amazing Academy Award-winning job that we've all done putting this together. And it's incredibly convincing, because I mean, like right now, I think I am a specific person talking to another specific person, and which was recording on a specific computer, and it's going to go out of over a specific website to specific people who will hear it. It's like, wow, that's pretty. I mean, who would
That's
argue with
pretty
that?
impressive,
I mean, it's what an elaborate system, you know?
You know, which is also why I think the Titanic is such a great analogy sometimes, because you know, what the feeling was about that. I mean, what a triumph, what a victory, what a an accomplishment, an unsinkable ship. And it took one voyage, you know, to prove it wrong. And I'm not going to say a simple thing. In fact, you know, I think over time they realized there were a number of different kind of perfect storm situations that came together, that any one of them, if they'd been different, would have saved a lot of lives. But just the idea that, you know, we can pour our hearts into something, but you know, we're never, you know, it kind of goes back to, and I've given this analogy before, if we're using those little stick-it notes that have the removable glue, it's never going to stick. I mean, it's only going to stick temporarily, because that's what it's meant to do. That's
That's a
what
good.
it's meant to do.
I
That's
like
its
that metaphor.
purpose.
See, that's good. I'm gonna use the sticky note metaphor, because
Yeah.
it's not gonna last, huh?
And if we think, what, you know, like, you wouldn't wrap a package with it, you know,
No,
it's sort of like
no.
we just keep pushing harder to make the nature be different, which also is something that Jeff said in the workshop, is that we can give the masks a new purpose. And see, that goes along with just what you were saying, you know, instead of getting all depressed and frustrated, just if we could laugh at ourselves, if we could forgive and just go, you know what, I'm going to give this mask a new purpose. You know, and not get all caught up in why did I create the mask and, you know, blah, 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 but just give everything a new purpose, which is such an important concept in the course anyway, is,
It
you know,
is.
like Ken says oftentimes, what's the purpose? What is the purpose for something? You know, what purpose are you giving anything? And if you could stop and look at that, you could change your mind.
And that's, I think, a great reminder that we can catch ourselves in mid-thought, mid-sentence, mid-whatever, in the act of choosing the ego, and say, oh, this isn't evil, you know, sinful or wicked. It's just silly. It's just ineffective. It's not achieving the peace that I really know I want to remember that I am. And I'm masking myself from that awareness of a peace that is so all-encompassing that we can, I, you know, I we can't imagine how profoundly wonderful that is from within the dream, from, you know, from the battlefield of the holodeck that we think we're sinking on.
Yes. Well, and you know, another idea that I love from this workshop, just, you know, the reminder, is that we all think we're victims.
Right.
We all think we're victims. And, truthfully, I came to that as a psychological principle, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago. And because I had lived my life, and maybe I've told you this, I had lived my life really believing that people absolutely knew right from wrong. And that all those people that were doing wrong things, they knew it. And if you could just get them to admit it. And somewhere along the line, I realized, I thought, no, you know what? They don't. I mean, whether you're stealing or whatever you're doing, you think there's a good reason for doing it. And usually it's because you're the victim. So, like, for instance, let's say your employer is not a fair person. So if you take something from them or they're kind of sloughing off and you're not doing all your work, well, that's fair because the employer isn't fair. We always think we're victims. I mean, that there's nobody who doesn't really believe that in their core. And I was kind of thinking about this yesterday because I was with a niece who is just a year old. She just turned a year old. And of course, she is just priceless in my eyes. I mean, she truly is. But we're walking hand in hand down the street, and she wants to go a certain way, and I'm not going to let her. I mean, she's not going to get to decide, right? And she doesn't want to hold my hand. And so she gets so, she kind of looks at me, and she's picked up this habit of she takes her one of her hands and she points her finger at you, and just she's not verbal yet. I mean, so she's just rah, 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 it's not making sense, but she's like giving it to me because I'm not taking her where she wants to go. And I just thought how funny, because I have heard in workshops with Susan Dugan, just that idea that, we think of babies as totally innocent. But in truth, we all come in with a victim mentality. So she's already giving me hell, so to speak, because she's a victim and I'm not doing what she wants, what she wants to do. And she's already got it, that, she, this is what I want and please do it. And if you don't, I'm the victim and I'm going to cry.
That reminds me of another favorite thing that, Ken mentioned is in probably several of his workshops, where if we could really interpret babies' vocalizations of the wah, wah, wah. What they're really saying, in the pre-verbal phase is it's not my fault. It's not my fault. I didn't choose to come here.
That's
I was forced into this body.
right. That's right. And I think they are. I think they are, But.
But we forget that, as the Course also points out, and Ken reminds us, that, the Course never refers to us as adults. It also always, basically alludes to the idea that we're infants here. We're just in the early phase, which is actually kind of encouraging, because that means that we have a lot more that we can undo, and we can use the cues from our external world that are really reflections of our mind's decision for one thought system or another as a wonderful classroom and an opportunity. We can use those masks and those facades and all the specifics that they embody as ways to get back to the mind and ways get back to that decision-making fulcrum, that focal point that can choose against ego's misinterpretations and then have a happier dreamer.
Right. And it also reinforces our innocence.
Yeah,
You know,
exactly.
that ultimately we're innocent. You know, we're not victims. We're innocent. And we've just taken on those masks and we're believing those, fragmented masks for other people as well.
Right. And the innocence is such a crucial thing too, because if we really truly knew that we had done nothing wrong, that we were completely innocent, and that's part and parcel and inseparable from realizing that everyone else is in that same state, which kind of ties into what you're just talking about. That is something we can't even imagine how wonderful that would be. And I think that's why, innocence is one of the pivotal ideas in the course that again is one of those things that used in from the right mind, it includes everyone. But once the ego gets a hold of the word innocence, it says, "Oh, well, I'm innocent and you're not." Or vice versa, there's always a difference, and as long as there's a difference, we're basically fracturing perfect oneness, and that's the whole unfounded, unconscious premise of guilt. Because what else would we be guilty of? If this is a dream, the only thing that we could possibly imagine, and it's all only in our imaginations, that we committed as a crime was to make up something where there were differences and that things were separate, and that the home, to use those kind of familial metaphors, was somehow torn apart. And but it didn't happen.
Right.
our infinite and eternal family is safe at home while we're dreaming of exile.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always see them as sitting in a restaurant bar, and they're all drinking and laughing, and when I first started studying the course, it did occur to me, oh my God, it's not that I'm waiting for them, they're waiting for me.
Yeah.
They're waiting for me to get it. And, we just like when you go into a restaurant and they don't sit your whole party until everybody's there.
Uh-huh.
We don't go to heaven alone. And so I thought, oh, my gosh, they're all in the bar waiting for me. And they're going, when is CA going to get it?
That's a pretty good metaphor. I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I just kind of imagine, and that's it. They're not in any pain. They're just joking and laughing and having a good time. And they're more than willing to wait for me to get it, They're not looking at their watches.
Right. And that's such a helpful idea, because if we make our peace of mind contingent on anyone else or anything else for that matter, we're basically just saying, well, I'm not quite ready to forgive myself. I'm not quite ready to reveal my investment in ego, release it, and then allow Holy Spirit to replace it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, we can't quite imagine what else would be there.
Yeah.
Yeah,
right.
There's a part in the text in chapter 20 where it says, what if you recognize the world was a hallucination? And it goes on, but it basically says, if you really believe that, if you could really recognize that, then could you accept that idea? But better yet, then what would you see?
Right.
And I think that's intriguing, because isn't that kind of what we're afraid of is, whoa, well, if this isn't real, what is it going to look like?
Yeah.
I mean, better hold on to what I know than to let go for what I don't.
Right. Because we think that there's something here, and the Course doesn't try to take that away. Somewhere it says something to the effect of, it doesn't seek to deprive us of the little we think we have.
Right.
Yeah. I just found the quote that you were looking for, that you were mentioning. I think this is the one. It's in section 8. Paragraph 7, it says, what if you recognize this world as an hallucination? What if you really understood you made it up? What if you realize that those who seem to walk about in it, to sin and die, attack and murder and destroy themselves, are wholly unreal? That's W-H-O-L-L-Y. Could you have faith in what you see if you accepted this? And would you see it?
Yep, that's it.
Yeah.
Would you see it?
Yeah. Why? If we really understood how painful it is, and how much we suffer needlessly from investing in an identity that's dysfunctional, would we want to keep doing it? What would it feel better if we stopped banging our head against the wall?
Yeah, but I have real life experiences with that too. Mm-hmm. And specifically in a couple of situations where somebody was even telling me, and actually it came out through a tarot card, but somebody kept even telling me, when you're willing to stop the pain, then you will. And I'm like, but I'm not in pain. I'm not in pain.
Right.
And years later, I could see it.
Masters of denial
and
we are.
Yes. And so all of a sudden I'm going, oh, he must have been sitting there going, yeah, she's a master of denial. Here's the thing. I would still go back and defend myself and just say, but that's it. I wasn't ready to see it. I was not ready to see it. After the fact,
yeah.
I could go back and go, do you realize how much agony you just put yourself through? That really wasn't a happy situation. You could have gotten out of that situation much earlier or easier, but I didn't. I mean, it was sort of, I'd almost say it's like the frog in the hot water. If you put the frog in the hot water just keeps getting hotter and the frog doesn't know it. That's exactly it. I didn't know anything else. I thought, isn't that what you're supposed to feel?
Uh-huh.
It's sort of like when I was in my early 20s, I used to wear these really high heels because I'm only 5'2". And it wasn't until I stopped wearing them that I realized, oh, your legs aren't supposed to hurt at the end of the day? I thought, isn't that just what your legs feel like?
Uh-huh.
That's what your knees or your feet or your ankles feel like. I mean, that was just normal.
Yeah.
And I was only in my 20s, and all of a sudden I'm like, Wow. You know, your feet don't feel the same, or your legs don't feel the same if you don't wear high heels. And so, I think it's the same with some of the stuff in the course or with a lot of things in our lives. Somebody can even tell us we're in pain, but we want to hold on to it, and because we know it's familiar. And that's why we need to bring the unconscious to the conscious.
And use all the specifics of our lives as our classroom.
Yes, as a classroom, right.
And we could, because getting rid of that classroom is getting rid of the means for undoing our investment in it. In Inigo's thought system, that is.
But you don't need the classroom if you've learned the lessons. And as long as you haven't, you need the classroom. And that's why we can make everything there again, repurpose everything in our lives to work for our benefit, to work for our enlightenment or really understanding.
And like you say, noticing those discomforts, another metaphor that came to mind as you were talking about the high heels, which I've only done once on Halloween, but that was years ago.
And wasn't it comfortable?
No, it was not. Neither were the stockings, but anyway, that another story,
Oh, yeah.
or the lipstick, but the rock in the shoe, we do those kind of things. We it'd be, after a few days or weeks of walking with a rock in your shoe, you start wearing a hole in your foot or your shoe, and but you can take it out just by saying, I need a 10-second time out to take this thing out of my shoe, kind of thing. And I think that's, when we notice the discomfort, when we notice the angst or the dread or the anger or anything that is not perfect peace, it can be a cue or a reminder. And there's a and also I was reflecting back to a section, I'm not sure where in the course it exactly is, and I'm going to paraphrase it. Basically, it's when you recognize that you've picked up the sword again.
Yes.
Sometimes it's very unconscious, and we don't even realize that we're ready to wage war again, albeit on a symbolic level. But every time we feel the least bit out of sorts or angry or envious or hostile or depressed or what discouraged or whatever, those are all ways of telling ourselves, I'm giving in to a thought system that doesn't work for me, and I know it doesn't work for me on some level, but I don't want to lose the investment in the self that I made up. And that's okay, but we can remember that we have another choice. And the more that we remember that, and not necessarily change the behavior, but change the thinking while we're involved in the situation, the more we strengthen that mental muscle to shift the identity from the special specific character that we think we are to the decision-making mind. That is really, I think, the course's whole emphasis is trying to get us to re-identify with that awareness. The one that didn't think it was such a great idea to pick up the sword metaphorically.
Well, and I love that analogy in the course as well, because it just seems so, I mean, it just can so come to mind that you're going along and you think everything's great, and all of a sudden you realize you are dragging this heavy sword. It's hard work to do all that judgment. I think we talked about that a long time ago, that it's hard work to do all that judgment.
Oh, it's
We think it's hard to let it go, but it's really hard to carry it.
But that's only because we've trained our minds to think that ease and peace is this terrifying idea. And so we make comparative assessments of things, forgetting that all illusions ultimately are burdensome, except for perhaps the forgiveness illusion. And so really the only real alternative is to, as that section in the chapter 31 suggests, is to look honestly at the desolation that ego has made out of our hallucinated lives, and see that that isn't working for us, and that our identity, which we thought we threw away, has never been lost, and our real identity has been, like you say, sitting around the bar with the other aspects of ourselves, having
having a good time.
toasting and having a good time and just waiting for that part of our awareness to
To
wake up.
catch up,
Yeah,
yeah.
exactly.
Yeah, well, and on that image, it's time for us to close the show. Do you have any announcements that you'd like to make?
Well, actually, I do have one it's not quite ready for prime time yet, but I'm going to actually be participating in a conference in Estes Park, Colorado, the 16th through the 19th of June. It's the Weekend of Freedom Retreat, and Gary and Cindy Renard will be there, and David Hoffmeister and Dove Fishman and a bunch of other folks. I'll have more details later, and I'll put it on ACIM blog. But if you are going to be in the Denver area between the 16th and the 19th of June, you might want to check out that, and at least put those dates on your calendar tentatively, and if that might be of interest.
Okay.
And it's always nice to remind people of the two wonderful, the two primary websites about the course, facim.org, which is the folks in Temecula that are the Foundation for A Course in Miracles. Ken Wapnick's legacy lives on and continues unabated, and continues to excel and extend with the work of Jeff and Rosemary and the folks there, and all the wonderful academy classes that they do, and the FAQs that I read daily, and just because there's so many great ones. I'm up to about I think 1,020 now out of 1,300. The Lighthouse articles and the resources, there's just tremendous stuff there. And then also, of course, the ACIM.org, the Foundation for Inner Peace, on the other end of the state, with all the workbook lessons and the archives and the history and so much more. So anyway, always fun to just dive into those two websites and just see what's there, and such great resources.
Yeah, and great stuff. And I haven't been on there recently, and I want to check out what they've got coming up in 2016 in terms of those online streaming classes,
Yes,
because I
yes.
want to take another one.
Me too. Me too.
Yeah, it was
Absolutely.
great. Well, Bruce, thank you so much for being here
Thank
today.
you, TA. Always a pleasure.
Hey, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Likewise, very much.
Okay, bye-bye. Well, that's a wrap for today. Thanks for making A Course in Miracles part of your day. And I want to especially thank Bruce Rawls and mention his website as well, which is www.acimblog.com. And thanks to all the listeners and to everybody in the chat room. And thanks to our producer, Scott Weaver, for being here today. And I'd also like to shout out to Mark Husson, who, as you know, really is the person who introduced me to the course and is also the father of everything 1-2. So is responsible for really making 1-2 radio possible, and so that we can be on the air every Friday. So thank you, Mark, for your encouragement, for your inspiration, and for all the work that you do. Another announcement is that my other show, Simple Tales, on Tuesdays has moved. It's changed times. Still on Transformational Tuesday, but it's an hour earlier at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 Eastern. So you can find me there every Tuesday talking about astrology and a number of other topics as well, but mostly astrology. I'd also like to remind you, especially if you have started doing those lessons, those workbook lessons, if you started those in January, did you know that you can find written versions of those, text versions, on the 1-2-listen.com website? So if you look in the scope section every day, you can be reminded of what the lesson is. And also, you can actually hear recorded versions of those lessons if you go to the archives of 1-2 Radio and look under ACIM. Not this particular show, but just look under ACIM, and you're actually going to see the 365 lessons. So you can choose the date and listen to the lesson. But up next, you're going to be listening to some numerology with The Through Line with Christine Dumarier, who is coming up next on Fabulous Fridays on 1-2 Radio. And of course, she is followed by a number of other wonderful live shows. And please pay attention to our schedule, because we've actually made some changes. So if things aren't exactly as you remembered them, that's okay. It's 2016. It's a new year. It's time to shake some things up. So check out that schedule, and please check out all the live shows that we've got, and the encores and the archives as well. So until next week, relax and wear loose clothes. You have been listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks and my guest, Bruce Rawls, on 1-2 Radio, where we are changing the way you think about life and spirituality.